This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When historian Katie Simpson Smith was working on her PhD, she became fascinated with the American Revolution. She says she read every slave narrative from 1750 to 1850 and immersed herself in stories about an era filled with death, uncertainty, and upheaval. She wrote her dissertation about motherhood in the South, but later realized that this time period was also a perfect backdrop for her debut work of fiction, The Story of Land and Sea. The novel takes place in Beaufort, North Carolina, where two men who lost their wives during childbirth grapple with death, slavery, religion, and their own masculinity. Katie Simpson Smith joins us now to talk about her work of fiction. Hello, Katie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. You got your PhD in Southern women's studies. What interested you about early Southern women's history?
I think the period of the American Revolution and the years following it is a very ripe time for women's history. Especially because we have this sense, as historians, that we want to focus on those women that did exceptional things, women who somehow found their way into politics or into economics. And one thing I wanted to do with my dissertation was to sort of pull back from that and look at women's daily lives and what would have been most important to them, which for my dissertation was motherhood. And so I studied sort of how various different kinds of women, white, black, and Native American, raised their children very differently in this environment.
And what about that environment? How different was it in that period for women compared to just before and just after, for instance?
Right. One of the things that's, I think, very particular to the South is how these women existed sort of cheek by jowl with each other. There wasn't a sense of separation because in a lot of ways there couldn't be. White women raised their children on plantations with black women, and Native American women were involved in trade with both groups of women. And so there was this sense that that women could watch over each other and witness each other's parenting methods with varying degrees of judgment and scorn, but still the sense that especially in this new nation, that there was a project that they were all involved in.
Were women more intimately related than men at the time?
I think there was more room for connection, if only because women focusing on the home front had to, you know, be in the kitchen with other women, had to depend on other women to help raise their children. So they weren't really allowed to be quite as independent as men were.
And I guess, conversely, it was more permissible for them to have closer relationships than in what was becoming a more segregated form of social structure among men.
Right. And that didn't always lead to friendship commonality, but friction as well.
Well, that brings us to your novel, because that's certainly an element in the book. So tell us about what led you to from the academy. You haven't left the academy, but to start writing fiction.
I think what led me to fiction was the sense that I wanted to get more into the emotional minds of these women and of people who were living in this very difficult environment. The novel is set in the town of Beaufort, North Carolina, which by the end of the 18th century was in decline. It had been a colonial hub earlier in the century. But, you know, economic centers had shifted, and these characters are engaged in a world that is sort of slowly slipping away. And with my historical training, I'm so used to having to cite everything and having to support all my arguments with evidence. And here I was able to take that same foundation of research and move into a much more imaginative sphere, which was very freeing for me.
The novel was born out of an epitaph in a graveyard in Beaufort that caught your attention. Tell us about it.
Yes. Yeah, so there's an 18th century graveyard, which I think many North Carolina residents will be familiar with, in the old burying ground of Beaufort. And there is a grave there that has a headstone that says simply, "Little girl buried in rum keg." And there's no name and no date and very little historical information about her. But people leave shells and children's toys and flowers on the grave, which sort of speaks to the way that story has an emotional impact on modern visitors. And it certainly did for me as well. When I saw The Grave, I immediately wanted to figure out what that story was and how she got into such an unusual grave.
Well, in some ways, that story became The Story of Land and Sea, your first novel. Tell us about the characters.
So it starts off with John, who is a widower and also an ex-pirate who was in the Continental Army as well. His wife, Helen, has died in childbirth, and he is left to raise his 10-year-old daughter, Tabitha, by himself, which is proving a bit of a challenge. She's a very wild and ungoverned child. So the novel starts out with him in that sort of very, very intimate relationship, and then moves back in time to explore the growing up years of John's wife, Helen, and the enslaved woman named Moll, who Helen is given as a birthday present. And they grow up with friendship, but also a lot of tension. And then the final sort of main character is Asa, who is Helen's father and the owner of a turpentine plantation in Beaufort, who grapples with religion and sort of a conservative vision of his family that is challenged on many fronts.
Well, you know, it's interesting in our last conversation about the play Somewhere in Between, we were talking about these social constructions that have very rigid lines and markations, and then the way nature sort of breaks in and breaks those up. And in a lot of ways, that's what's going on in your novel as well, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. And in one of those ways that the social structures are broken up is the system of slavery, which we think of as being very rigid and we attach to, you know, large-scale cotton plantations in the South. But I wanted to show a kind of slavery that existed earlier and in a very different kind of environment. So this is a small town. This is a small plantation with only a few enslaved people living on it. And as a result, the relationship between owners and the owned is much more fluid. The woman, Moll, has an opportunity to voice her opinions at various points. And yet, even in this slightly more permissive version of slavery, she is constantly beaten down and forced into situations that she does not want to be in and has no control over.
And I think any stereotype that we would have had of slavery, whether it is a sort of a brutal institution with rigid lines or one in which some slave owners may have been more benign than others, and as you suggested earlier, the fact that women might have been more intimate doesn't mean necessarily that they had closer friendships or treated one another any better. I mean, a lot of that really becomes very complicated and kind of exquisite in this book, because what we thought we knew is far more complicated than we thought. Could I ask you to read an excerpt, and now that we're talking about Helen, who has died in childbirth, but we're going back now. She was given the enslaved woman, Moll, a gift at the age of 10 when Helen was 10 years old. Maybe you could, if you need more setting up, you can do that too.
Sure. So this is shortly after Helen's father, Asa, has presented the birthday gift of the enslaved child. For her 10th birthday, she is given a girl named Moll, who stands in the corner with blue ribbons in her hair. After her father leaves them, Helen stares at the child and wishes she had been given the ribbons instead. She has no sense of what to do with a Negro girl other than to make her fetch things. She advances slowly, and when the girl doesn't flinch, Helen reaches out and unties the satin loops. "Those mine," Moll says. Helen winds them between her fingers. Moll throws out an arm, grabbing at Helen, who twists around to protect her plunder. Moll scrambles onto the other girl's back, and within moments of the bedroom door closing, the two are scuffling on the ground, pulling at each other's ears. Moll, taller by an inch, prevails, and the girls lie on the floor, breathing heavily, while the slave twines the satin ribbons around the short puffs of her hair. "You try again," she says, "I'll kill you."
Katie Simpson Smith, the PhD in history, who has written her first novel, or published it anyway, The Story of Land and Sea. That's an excerpt from that novel. You use the word plunder in there, which then reminds us of pirates, which also reminds us of who owns what, because obviously the British get going in the whole colonial enterprise by pirating the loot of the Dutch, right? So all these questions of who owns what and who has permissions and who's the pirate and who's the owner are subtly kind of infused in this book. But this relationship of Moll and Helen is one that I want to get back to something you said earlier. As a PhD, you always had to support what you wrote in your papers. This now you could move into a deeper imagination. And yet there is a lot of support. You read all of these slave narratives and diaries. So to what extent, why is it different? Is there, there's a fundamental truth that's coming through in this book, isn't there?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I learned from all the slave narratives I read, which, you know, to be truthful, aren't that many. It sounds like a lot to read all of them from 1750 to 1850. But most of them were written by men. So we don't get a lot of enslaved women's voices, which is really difficult for the historian. So we're reading into words left by other people about these women's lives. And so there sort of has to be a certain amount of imagination. But one thing that these men who wrote these slave narratives often included was mention of their mothers. So the narratives often open with a paragraph about, you know, when I was a child in Virginia, my mother said such and such to me. And those short glimpses really illustrate how powerful the mother-child relationship was, and also how difficult. So many of these writers are remembering mothers who were torn from them or sold from them, or who they witnessed being abused, but also who, you know, under the cover of night tried to teach them how to read against the law. So Moll is kind of based on an amalgam of these women. You know, she's both sort of beaten down, but also defiant. And the way she interacts with the people around her reveals the kind of love she has for her children.
We've been talking about the women in this book, but men and masculinity do play an important part. John and Asa are key characters in this. And John's relationship with Tabitha, his daughter born after the death of his wife, or at the death of his wife, Helen, is also a very important relationship.
Right. And I hadn't really explored fatherhood before in my research, and it was kind of a new challenge for me. Most men in this time period who would have lost a wife would have remarried fairly quickly, especially if they had children to raise. And so what's unusual about John is that he tries to go it alone. And is never really certain that he's doing the right thing, but it allows me to look at this this kind of father-daughter relationship under a microscope, and I think it, you know, it reveals a lot about what men at the time period felt about parenthood and their own sense of duty.
Tabitha is dying of yellow fever. He has a relationship with the sea, obviously, as a pirate who has settled down a bit. I'd like you to read again for us, and I think this illustrates something all the critics have been saying, which is about the beauty and the grace in your writing as well. So maybe you can set up this passage for us.
Sure. So this next passage, Tab has come down with symptoms of yellow fever, and John, in an attempt to save her life, takes her on board a pirate ship bound for Bermuda. So she has sort of cycles of getting better and getting worse on the ship, and in this passage, she's getting a little bit worse. In this last hour of consciousness, Tab floats on the ocean, no ship beneath her, surrounded by her mother and father and grandfather and any brothers and sisters who are caught unborn in her mother's womb. She is part of a family halted. She blames the sea for being romantic and God for killing. The room fills up with ghosts. Her grandfather is singing death to her. She asks her hands to cover her ears, but they do nothing. She will not yield. Her limbs are steeled against God's assault. Her hairs enter each pore with pinpricks. Her whole body is alive to the sharpness of pain. The candlelight in the room blends with the darkness, and her vision slowly vanishes in a blackening muddle. The voices rise around her. Her hammock is wet with sweat and blood, is wet with the sea. She is leaving the world in a red storm through the body of one already dead. She can now remember what it was like to be born.
Katie Simpson Smith reading from her debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea. She blames the sea for being romantic and God for killing. And God and the sea both play an important part of this. They are characters in this.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the characters have very different relationships with both, and very sort of evolving relationships depending on how their lives go. I think religion here is a way for people to explain their lives as it is today. And I think we have a sense that religion in the past was more firm and that people simply believed what they were told. But certainly in this time in American history, you have a very changing idea about faith and about a very personal relationship to God that's coming out. And the men in the book who lose people they love have to determine to what extent God is playing a part.
The flashback in this book includes a passage where Helen meets a young soldier who has, again, we expect this guy, she says something like, well, I guess everybody has faith in war. And he says, no.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, I'm paraphrasing here. So how much of this book, how much of this story that is in this book now was clear to you and came to you when you read that epitaph in Beaufort?
Very little. I started off with a very small glimpse of the girl who would become Tabitha, and even thought of it maybe as a short story, just a sort of point A to point B, getting the girl into the rum keg. But then as I found her parents and her grandfather showed up in the story, I realized that the most important part of the tale was not the girl's death, but the sort of afterlife for those who loved her. And that's when I realized it was a much longer story.
Katie Simpson Smith talking about her debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thank you so much.
Katie's going to be reading from her book, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight and Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville tomorrow. You can get the details on those readings and much, much more if you go to our website, stateofthings.org. And if you want to find out more about bugs, hissing cockroaches to be exact, you can tune in tomorrow. We are live from the Nature Research Center in Raleigh. You can go to the Nature Research Center. We're kind of ensconced in a little tiny studio, but they project our image on the Daily Planet, the big screen, and there's a theater. So if you want to go and see the show, you can do that and get a pretty good close-up of the hissing cockroach and much, much more. All of that on The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mogdui, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.